This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to the February 15th, 2021 For Your Benefit radio show. Today, we have Dr. Josh Huder to discuss, PhD, doc, to discuss the 117th Congress. Josh is a senior fellow at the Governmental Affairs Institute at Georgetown University, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating federal employees about how Congress works and its operations. Good morning, Josh.
Morning, Bob. How you doing?
Well, real good now. I got that. I got the opening without stumbling, and the rest I'm going to listen to you. So when you lecture or when you talk to folks about how the government works, what do you do just as a prep? In other words, if I was to sign up for your course, which I would, I might not know what you do. So what do you do?
Yeah, well, we explain all the processes, legislative processes, politics that go into agency authorization, appropriations, basically like why you exist and how much you're funded, how much funding you get, are the things and processes that we explain. And there are a lot of things that affect this, like whether your agency is going to get a filibuster or not, how much time they have in the Senate, some of the problems that happen at the committee level, when your authorization, your appropriations going through. How the appropriations process works, or more accurately, doesn't work, and why, and how that affects agency budgets. So we walk you through all the different reasons and angles that affect agency interaction with Capitol Hill. And that ranges from everything from, going to an oversight hearing or understanding like how the appropriations process operates and funnels through, what they're thinking about when they're funding these programs and agencies. And how the sausage is made, essentially. Congress and the executive branch have a very, very important and interdependent relationship with one another. And so we try to create the sort of grease between in the gears to make it work a little bit better than it would otherwise, so that agency officials know what's going on and what members and staff are thinking about on the Hill and how they can work with them to make all of these processes work more smoothly.
So you've been at this for a while, and we now understand the heart of what you do. But how do you ever bring the two sides together, or are you talking more about the people that are going to work with Congress, or does Congress ever get involved?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be some interaction between staff in federal offices and people on Capitol Hill. Whether that's going to be, direct interaction with staff or responding to requests for information from Capitol Hill or, staffing one of your principals for a hearing on Capitol Hill or a briefing on Capitol Hill or something along those lines, members of the executive branch are the ones that are going to have to understand the context and character of the meetings that they're going into. So we don't directly put them in contact with one another, right? Congress and the agencies typically speak to one another directly. But we try to give agencies the right sort of frame of mind and environmental perspective to understand what they're stepping into when they're speaking with members and staff on Capitol Hill.
So when you address the class, when you teach the class, do you start off very gingerly or very overview and then dig in? And do you then let the questions guide, not dictate what you say, but guide what you say?
Yeah, so we approach it from, everything from 50,000 foot level to, 500 foot level. We start out really, really broad. It's kind of starts as a course in civics, but on steroids. We get you really, really involved interested in sort of the broad structure of government, why this is the way it is, and how we got here. Then we go into the actual legislative processes that dictate this stuff. And then we get more and more detail where we bring in staff, current and former, to discuss, the difference between, approaching an individual member versus approaching a committee, and the differences between approaching the House and the Senate. The differences between and the types of things that are affecting the politics at the chamber level, and why a lot of the sort of political opinions, the diverse political opinions, get funneled into two partisan orientations, and how that affects congressional processes and funding and all the other things that affect federal agencies. So we do a little bit of it all, right? Everything from 50,000 foot level to 500 foot level. We try to give you that nuanced perspective and sophisticated understanding of the legislative branch.
So you've been doing this with an evenly divided Congress, polar Congress and the like. So if you were, I guess if we were to look at it now, what can we collectively expect from an evenly divided Congress?
Well, it's a lot different than what we were expecting after the 2020 election, that's for sure. I think that was the biggest surprise on election night, is the fact that a lot of people assumed that Democrats were going to have a large unified government, right? Joe Biden was up 8 or 9 points in the polls nationally. He had huge leads in really important swing states. Like, there were polls saying that he was up like 8 in Wisconsin, that he was up 5 in Pennsylvania. He was up like 6 or 7 in Michigan. He was tied in Florida. He was kind of up in North Carolina. He was tied in Georgia. I mean, there was a widespread belief or expectation that Democrats were going to have pretty sizable majorities. They were going to add to their majority in the House by about 15 seats. They were going to go from 233 to like 248 or so. They were going to add 6 or 7 Senate seats and take that majority with a sizable margin. And then win the presidency by a landslide, or close to a landslide, or by a really sizable margin. And I think the big surprise is that we found out it was not going to be that sizable at all. Democrats ended up losing 13 seats overall in the House. They ended up picking up the Senate majority after a very, very unusual and unexpected double win in the Georgia runoff elections on January 5th. So now the Senate chamber is currently 50-50. It's tied with a vice president tiebreaker, which is why Democrats now hold the majority in the Senate. And Joe Biden snuck through. He won the states that he had to win, didn't win them by very much. In fact, only 65,000 votes separated a victory from a President Trump's second term, which is actually 22,000 less than President Trump won by in 2016. So if Wisconsin, Michigan, and Arizona flipped along with Nebraska too, we'd be looking at another Trump presidency after 2020. So it was really kind of a razor thin margin. And there are a few reasons for that. We found out that our polling in the Midwest was really, really bad. There's some fundamental flaws with the way that they're measuring public opinion in places like Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, that they're showing a lot of a really intense skew toward the Democratic side of the aisle. Same thing in Florida. They were missing Florida by about 4 or 5 points. But in other areas, it was very accurate. So polling was really accurate in like Georgia and North Carolina and Arizona and some states in the Sun Belt. So, you know, expectations shifted pretty dramatically between the day before Election Day and the day of Election Day. And now that you have this very, very tightly contested unified majority, it's going to be interesting because all of a sudden some very, very conservative Democratic senators become the real crux of what's going to happen on Capitol Hill. These are people like Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who Donald Trump won West Virginia by about 39 points this past election. And Joe Manchin's a Democrat from that state who will be determining what parts of the Democratic platform actually make it through the Senate. Same thing, Kyrsten Sinema, Mark Kelly, both senators from Arizona. Ms. Sinema is on the more conservative side. We'll find out what kind of senator Mark Kelly is going to be. He's up for re-election in 2 years. We have 2 senators from Georgia, right, that are going to be in there. We have senators from Montana. These are all Democrats in pretty red or purplish states that are going to be determining what happens in the Senate floor, because that's the narrowest margin that we have. Over in the House, you have the same sort of problem. You have some very, very conservative constituencies that'll be determining the balance of power over there. Democrats' majority right now is at 221. So it's just 3 north of 218. They got about 4 vote majority because of some other vacancies. But that's going to drop here in a little bit. Marsha Fudge will be confirmed as HUD secretary. So it's going to go down to 220. So they're working with an extremely narrow majority in the House. So they're listening very closely to conservative constituencies like Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, and there are a few others in California. But you know, the expectations that Democrats are going to come in and start doing Medicare for All or like the Green New Deal or any of that stuff, well, that was never going to happen anyway. But this is certainly not going to happen with a very, very narrow majority. And so their expectations shifted pretty dramatically. And so processes like budget reconciliation have become much more important, which is something that you're going to be hearing over and over and over again. It's an important process that enables the Senate to get around a filibuster, and often also constrains what Democrats can do. So they can't do like big regulatory pushes, like things like large financial services regulations or insurance company regulations. Those are not going to be able to get passed through the Senate through a majority only process, which means that all of those priorities in the Democratic Party are going to be filibusterable. So really what you can do by a majority vote only is a lot of budgetary stuff. And that's going to be the focus both on the COVID relief package that's being currently negotiated and the package that'll come and another budget reconciliation package that'll come later in 2021. That'll likely deal with healthcare and some other stuff. But certainly expectations have changed, and the agenda went from potentially a much broader agenda, a more ambitious agenda, to one that's more narrowly tailored to budgetary impacts and things, just because of the way the politics of the election worked out and the processes that govern how all of those priorities will be passed through the House and the Senate.
You mentioned the term filibuster. Now, I've heard filibuster since forever. What is a filibuster?
Filibuster actually comes from it's a term of piracy from the 1850s, but essentially what it is, it basically is talking something to death, like preventing it from coming to a vote by continuing to talk. Long ago in the Senate, they have kept this tradition of unlimited debate, quote unquote, unlimited debate. And that framed the way the Senate debated and talked for a very long time. But the filibuster is essentially the manifestation of unlimited debate. It requires a supermajority of senators to agree to stop talking. And that supermajority of senators that have to agree to stop talking is effectively the margin of passage that a bill has to reach in order to move forward now. As the parties have become more intensely partisan and more intensely polarized, members in the minority party are much more willing to filibuster almost everything that the majority wants to do. And so by doing that, by exercising their right to debate, they're forcing the Senate to stop debate by 60 votes, which means that all 50 Democrats plus 10 Republicans would have to agree to cut off debate in order to get to anything that would require just a majority passage. So you're looking at a 60 vote chamber, essentially, on most legislation and most things that come before the Senate. So a filibuster is really just talking something to death, but in kind of mechanical terms, it means that you need 60 votes to cut off debate in order to pass something in the Senate.
Wow. Thank you. I think it's time for a break. So we'll take a break and let the good folks from WAPA, who sponsor the show, talk about what they can do for the listeners.
Federal open season is over, but there's never been a better time to reevaluate your life insurance coverage. Get life insurance for less with WAPA. WAPA has been insuring the future of federal employees for more than 75 years. WAPA can be used as a supplement or replacement for your existing policy and can cost less than Fegley. In fact, last year, members who switched saved $375 on average. Although open season is over, you can apply anytime for WAPA group term life insurance. See how much you can save by visiting WAPA.org today.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here with Dr. Josh Huter, and he's PhD with he's a senior fellow at the governmental affairs at the Institute of Georgetown University, which is a not-for-profit organization dedicated to education of the federal employee about how Congress and how it works. And thus far, you've been spot on. I've got some questions, though, some email questions. And this first one, I think, kind of plugs into what you've been talking about. And here it is. Why isn't a public financing of elections debated in order to have a respective government that will listen to its constituents? Our members put in an important committees based on campaign donations to the party. So probably the first part of that, and then we'll briefly touch on the second.
Yeah. So public financing is something that's been an ongoing debate on Capitol Hill. One of the things that, and keep in mind, we do have public financing of presidential races. That was passed a long time ago. And it says something along the lines of there's a match of dollars, of donating dollars, up to a certain amount. I believe it was $50 million. I don't remember what if that's changed recently or not. This is something that's been continually introduced on in the House and in the Senate, but it doesn't get much traction. Like most campaign finance legislation, it gets filibustered in the Senate, and it dies in the House, right? There's not much traction on that front either. Now, some Democrats have proposed some stuff that's in their big kind of democracy bill, their big major priority for this particular piece of legislation, but it's unlikely that this provision is going to survive the filibuster in the Senate. One of the reasons that you don't see much attraction for public financing is the simple fact that many times now, members of Congress can really out-fundraise public financing. You can see a lot of members of Congress are raising, you know, double digits, tens of millions of dollars for elections. They are spending a huge amount of money. And if you are a public finance campaign, often the case is that you cannot compete with a super PAC or something that has unlimited resources and unlimited contributions. So in many cases, members of Congress probably don't see a need for that because they can out fundraise public financing. That's not to say that the merits of public financing don't matter. It's just that the politics of money at the moment kind of preclude public financing from getting on the agenda or being a significant factor when it is introduced, right? Presidents would never go for public financing today because they can raise, you know, 5, 6, 7 times the amount that they could actually get from public contributions. There's a kind of a double whammy there that's doing that. Do campaign contributions help a member in to get a favorable committee seat? Like, yeah, absolutely. This is something that's really become part and parcel for members of Congress. Back in a century ago or so, it's not uncommon that kind of most loyal partisans are the ones that are going to get the best committee seat or committee assignment. That's not unusual at all in American history. It's something that we've seen, going back centuries even. What's changed is that the amount that money plays within our political system, and that's become dramatically increased since the 1970s. And as money has become more and more important to congressional campaigns, raising money and fundraising has become a more important component of members' everyday activities. So on any given day, when a member of Congress is looking at their schedule, they'll see time on there for committee hearings. They'll see time on there for constituent meetings. They'll see time on there for other legislative meetings. And then they'll also see a couple hours, maybe four, up to four, which is what's recommended by some of the parties, of call time, where members of Congress are just on the phone with the Rolodex going through high dollar donors, asking them to contribute to their campaign or PAC. As money has become more important, also distributing money to your colleagues has become more important. So when you are kind of doling out resources for others within your party to help fund their campaigns and help them get reelected or elected in some competitive districts, it becomes a more important factor for the party and for party leaders as they look around to see which members will get placed on which committee. So if you are doing really well and you are fundraising for your colleagues as well, in addition to yourself fundraising well, you're more likely, it's sort of like a something you can put on the scale to tip it in your favor when you're looking to, say, get that Ways and Means spot or something on appropriations, one of those kind of like real big prestigious committees that have a lot of influence and discretion over public policy. So it absolutely has become an important part of how members get committee assignments, because simply money has become a more important part of members' lives and their political fortunes.
Okay, now when they get elected, would you say that this is an accommodating Congress?
When you say accommodating, what do you mean?
Well, they're not polarized. They're, you know, this is my side. I'm only going to go for Republican issues or Democratic. There's got to be some middle ground. I mean, the people are always going to be on the far side of the discussion.
Yeah, this is a great point. There's always going to be some polarization, right? And these people often get the most press, right? So they're the ones that you see most often on TV. They're the ones who are getting all of the quotes on in news stories about Congress. So, for example, and that's something that the press does. They really intensify and focus on that kind of like inter-party competition and fight. And there are several measures that suggest that we are an extremely polarized and partisan period in American history. That's not to say that it is a completely partisan institution. In fact, that would be a huge mistake, to be honest with you. Congress still passes large bipartisan legislation, and they do it on most things that become law. So one of the more interesting pieces of research that's come out within the last couple of years has shown that about 75% of all bills that become law still pass with large bipartisan majorities. And that's often very misleading. Many people think like, well, that's, you know, well, surely this is more or less bipartisan than it used to be. And in fact, it's really kind of not. A lot of the legislation that becomes law is still on par with those Congresses in the 1960s and the 1970s that we think of as like the bipartisan era of politics. The reality is Congress does a lot of bipartisan things that just doesn't really get the press that it deserves. So, for example, there was that big omnibus package at the end of the 116th Congress that included all the appropriations for the entire year, which was $1.4 trillion. In addition to $900 billion in COVID relief, it had some diplomatic changes. It included a consulate in Tibet. It had some climate change legislation in there. It had, a bunch of regulations to prevent surprise billing from hospitals. And all of this stuff was passed with a large bipartisan majority. So yes, our politics is often more animated and more clearly in one camp or the other. But it's simply also the case that Congress still acts in very bipartisan ways. It just doesn't get the kind of attention or press that many of these bipartisan things do. And it's very interesting, Senator Lamar Alexander, who just retired this past Congress, he said, you know, we've got this kind of Congress in split screen, right, where you see, you know, everything that gets attention is the really partisan and really animated stuff. And then behind the scenes, there's a lot of bipartisanship where people work or members of both parties work on legislation to get the final passage and create law. And so you've got two things going on at the same time. We just get a lot of the partisanship while we don't get a lot of attention to the bipartisanship.
Okay, well, your eloquence just brought us to the next question. What is the future of the Republican Party? Is there a chance of a viable third party?
You know, this is going to be the ongoing question moving forward. The Republican Party is kind of deciding its future at the moment. We have the very establishment wing of the Republican Party, so like the Mitch McConnells, the Paul Ryans, Rob Portman's of the world, where they're very traditionally conservative, small government, low spending, fiscally conservative types. And then there's been this kind of like populist uprising in the wake of President Trump, who really did animate and shift the party's priorities in some substantial ways. He wasn't able to pass many of these things. So for example, like his large infrastructure package that he wanted to really pass and reframe the Republican Party didn't get much traction in Congress at all. It never came up for a vote. Nonetheless, you're starting to see many members of the Republican Party sort of mimic that approach, where they're more willing to spend money and allow the government to intervene in the economic sector more freely and more frequently. And so the question is, who's going to win? And, you know, that's anybody's question at the moment. Like, what's going to define the Republican Party is an ongoing question. And we saw that just this past week with impeachment, as the Senate acquitted the president 57-43 this past weekend. And nobody really knows. This is going to be something that we'll have to figure out moving forward. That whether or not there's going to be a third party is going to be interesting in and of itself. That kind of there's the belief that it's kind of like a center-right party could emerge potentially. I don't know. Third parties are really difficult to get much traction in Congress, right? Our two-party system is very strong, and third parties that do emerge are often absorbed by one of the two major parties. So, for example, in the early 2000s, like the Green Party was absorbed by Democrats largely. The Tea Party movement, right, which wasn't actually a Tea Party, it was nonetheless absorbed largely by Republicans in the 2010s, and that's more commonly the feature of American politics. You know, third party movements get absorbed by one of the two major parties, so it's going to be difficult for a third party to emerge. Not impossible, but difficult. And it really will depend on what the Republican Party looks like in 2 to 4 years and what the electoral results look like in 2 to 4 years. If Republicans win by large margins running on a similar type of platform to the president in 2022, well, it looks like the party might continue that trajectory toward a more populist strain of conservatism. But if it doesn't, if Democrats somehow manage to beat the odds and the expectations of 2022, it's very possible that the center of the Republican Party kind of reestablishes itself. It's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you, but it's certainly something that everybody's trying to keep a finger on right now.
All right. Here's something that they might have a finger on. And this is, again, another question. I don't make these up. All right. Is some sort of climate change bill finally going to pass Congress?
This was one of the surprises of the 116th Congress. The very end of the year, that COVID, that like giant COVID omnibus spending bill that went through Congress, the 2 point whatever it was, the massive bill, it was 5,593 pages. This thing was a big
5,900 and
yes.
What?
Yeah, 5,593 pages long. It was enormous. It was an appropriations bill, a COVID bill, and then it had a bunch of other stuff in there, like lots and lots and lots of different legislation. In that bill. Was one of the most important climate change pieces of legislation that Congress has ever passed, ever. There was $35 billion included for energy innovation. There was a lot of stuff about reducing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and carbon capture technology. It was a historic piece of legislation for that alone. And so Congress did pass a major piece of climate change. Nobody heard about it again, of course, because many bipartisan members of Congress don't necessarily want that to become the issue of the day, and all of a sudden partisan tensions take over. But it was a major, major piece of legislation. And Democrats are surely going to want to try to continue that sort of momentum now that they have a majority in Congress. The question is, how will they get it across the line? It's probably unlikely that they'll be able to get it through the regular order. So just like introducing a climate change bill, working it through the House, working it through the Senate, it's probably not in the cards. But it's quite possible that they get it attached to another big omnibus package or an authorization bill of some sort, and try to like kind of wedge it through the process through another means. For people who are interested in climate change policy, that was a major piece of legislation that snuck through at the very end of the 116th Congress. And surely people in the 117th Congress are going to be wanting to continue that momentum.
You speak positively about how these bills get through. In other words, you explain to the listeners, me included, what makes a piece of legislation zing through versus not? I mean, that probably we could spend a month on, but what would be the visual of that? I mean, you know, this really looks like it'll go through on the first try, or no, this is going to be a long haul.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a great question. The really, really easy way to tell if something is going to become a law or not is whether or not it's bipartisan when they're debating it. And I know that sounds really simplistic, but it is true that the parties sort of like pick and choose the pieces of legislation and the issues that will become law or not become law. Like there are different goals within the legislative process. Many times today, the parties are picking things that divide them from one another, right? So they're looking to pass legislation that will make their party look good and the other party look bad, right? This is kind of like the campaign material, like these kind of messaging bills. This stuff never becomes law, almost never becomes law, because you have the separation of powers, right? It's very difficult to get through the House, the Senate, and then have the president sign something. The Senate also has a filibuster, which is going to require 60 votes on almost everything that goes through the legislative process. So a lot of these kind of messaging bills, these really intensely partisan pieces of legislation, die really, really quickly. But that said, these committees continue to work on bipartisan legislation, and the stuff that becomes law is bipartisan from the start. So the committees work on it in a bipartisan fashion. It is often reported out of committee to the House and Senate floors in a bipartisan fashion. It gets a bipartisan vote in those chambers. And then the other chamber will pick it up because, again, it has bipartisan support in the other chamber. So you see these things happen all the time where you have like the kind of really contentious piece of legislation that divides the parties, and then these bipartisan pieces of legislation that, they just don't get the same kind of attention. Partisan attention, I should say. So it's really easy to tell if something's going to become a law or not, because 9 times out of 10, it's going to have a large bipartisan majority at the committee level, when they first pass it and when they send it over to the other chamber. It's just depending on what are the goals here of the people who are trying to write the legislation. Are they political goals or are they policy goals? And that's what you kind of have to ferret out a little bit. And sometimes they do both. So, for example, Republicans passed this large sweeping repeal of Dodd-Frank in the 116th Congress. That bill died, didn't go anywhere because it went to the Senate where Democrats filibustered it. Despite that, they passed several smaller pieces of legislation that contained parts of that big Dodd-Frank repeal that were passed on bipartisan majorities in both chambers and became law. So it really does depend on what the goals of the party are, the goals of the majority are. And those change depending on the issue and on the content of the policy.
Okay, so here's a question. You're a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University. And I'm listening and I'm taking some notes, and I'm sure other people are listening and say, I didn't even know something like this existed. So is there a website that they can go to, or things that they can read on it? I've gone on it several times since I was introduced to you all, 10, 12 years ago?
Yeah. We have a website. It's gai.georgetown.edu. And you can go on there. You can find resources to our courses and our classes. We also maintain a blog that is kind of like an updating of what's going on in Capitol Hill or on Capitol Hill that federal workers should be aware of, whether that's an appropriations process thing or, you know, whether that has to do with COVID relief. We try to keep our readers up to date on what's happening from an academic and practitioner kind of perspective. So if you go to gai.georgetown.edu, you'll be able to find our resources and our info there.
Do that one more time slow.
gai.georgetown.edu.
Okay, very good. After that, I think it's time for break. Andrew says yes, so we'll be back in a few.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to the final leg of For Your Benefit. It's February 15th, 2021. We're talking with Dr. Josh Huter, PhD, and he's a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University, as if you couldn't tell prior to the break. So we have what do we got, Andrew? About 15 minutes? Andrew says 15 minutes. So here's one more question, this is maybe a good one. All right, he said, did your guest predict a second impeachment? Is this a risky move for the Biden administration? probably we won't need any more time if you answer that.
No, I did not predict a second impeachment. I thought for sure they were just going to run out the clock. But, you know, there was a historic event that happened on January 6th. The sacking of the Capitol, the insurrection that happened that day, really did spark something that I don't think anybody could have predicted without that event occurring. So after January 6th came through, the House moved to impeach the president a week later, and they did. They then could or tried to send that to the Senate. After the House impeaches, they send the articles to the Senate to actually try the impeachment. But what had happened is that following the counting of electoral votes, which the mob delayed for a little bit, for a few hours, the House and Senate recessed, right? So they went home. And during that recess, the Senate cannot receive any impeachment papers. So up until January 19th, the Senate was unable to try the president. That delayed the impeachment trial until after President Trump had left office. It was something that the Biden administration has tried to stay away from, for better or worse. They're sort of like not taking a public stance on it one way or the other. And they're also not telling members of the Democratic leadership to stop or not to stop the impeachment. They let them handle that. As I think that the Biden administration kind of rightly understood that it was the Article I branch of government sort of responding to an Article II branch attack. And so there was a kind of very big constitutional question there. The Senate just acquitted on Saturday that President Trump was in fact not guilty. But, you know, this was a very, very interesting vote, both in the House and in the Senate. It was the most bipartisan impeachment in American history, with 10 Republican votes in the House and 7 Republican votes in the Senate. It was certainly not something I don't think anybody predicted, but nonetheless, I'm not surprised that the impeachment happened and that the trial or the vote to convict was as large and as bipartisan as it was. This is really kind of historically unusual, and despite the fact that the president was acquitted on inciting an insurrection, it was a notable moment in American history that will not be quickly forgotten, for sure.
Okay. The courses that you teach, who do you find sitting in the classroom? Is it government employees? Is it private industry? Is it all the above? And the courses, I won't tell you which one is the most popular, but the question is what has the largest draw, federal employees or non-feds that want to understand?
It's 98% feds. We had some people from the private sector that come in and take our classes, but it's really 90% federal workers. And we are an institute that is dedicated to educating people. So we can do this either in a kind of like broad open-ended thing. We have something called the Congressional Operations Seminar, which just brings federal workers from all the agencies across the federal government to come and take a class on Congress, essentially. And we can do it also for many tailored groups. So we do specialized classes for the Navy. We do specialized classes for the Air Force. We have some tailored classes that can be recommended and or sought out. So we do specialized classes for other agencies that want to have the very specific issues within their jurisdictions appreciated. So if you are looking at a tailored class, something that's specific to an agency, we will talk about your authorization process. We will speak to your appropriators. We will speak to staffers and members that are relevant to your agency, that are most relevant to your agency within Congress, and that care the most about those agencies and those programs because they have the closest political connection to them. We do a wide range of stuff, but the people who come to our classes are overwhelmingly federal workers. And the question is just, what kind of audience are we talking to? Are we talking specifically to one particular agency or service, or are we speaking to a broad array of agencies? And either one is an appropriate way to go through the class to get a better understanding. But obviously, they have slight differences in the way that we approach the content.
Were you still able to produce the webinars, seminars, and not have them live? Is virtual taken over?
It has. You know, the pandemic's been a struggle for everybody. Right? Everybody's taking many more Zoom calls. They're taking many more online classes. So we went completely online in July of last year. And so if you sign up for one of our courses now, you get almost all the same content, right? There are a couple things that you can't do now that we used to do. So for example, we used to send out our participants to go and watch committee hearings like live and in person to see, you know, how committee hearings are conducted, how chairman and ranking members cooperate with one another. We also sent them out to go see, watch the House and Senate galleries to watch floor debate live and in person. Obviously we can't do these things anymore. But for the most part, we do almost everything in the same way that we did. We bring in staff, we bring in experts, both policy and political, to speak about these things. We go through all the processes that are relevant to agencies. And despite the fact you can't go and like watch the House and Senate floor live, we still walk you through those processes and using video and other techniques to kind of get you oriented to what's going on in the committee hearings. Why they're happening and what it means for the agency and or official. So we're doing all of this remote like everybody else is these days. And it's a little bit different, but we've still mostly the same content, almost all the same course components. And basically the same, you're getting the same type of information that you need to understand Congress more thoroughly.
So you and I have talked over the airwaves for a number of years, and I think now I understand what you all do, but I bet there aren't people. So somebody that says, gee, they do this, their reward then is to understand the process of the legislation. I don't know if you get into dynamics with regards to projecting what percentage of the Republicans will vote this way or the Democrats. Do you get down and dirty that way with standard deviations and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to predict, right? Those are things that can change on the fly. And it's part of like a live process that we try to show members, federal officials, about how the politics can change from place to place. So for example, we just heard a clip about how women may be eligible for the Selective Service. That was something that was in your news clip at the very beginning of the segment. And this is a topic that popped up randomly in about 2016 during a National Defense Authorization Committee hearing. They were marking up a bill, and a Republican member of Congress offered to make women eligible to the Selective Service. And that was an amendment that his chair didn't really like, that the chairman, this Republican chairman, did not want on the bill and did not want to get a vote. But nonetheless, this Republican member from California wanted to offer this amendment. And so he did. He offered the amendment, and to the surprise of a lot of people and the shock of a lot of people, this amendment ended up getting a majority of the committee. And so all of a sudden, the Selective Service became like a hot button issue in 2016 because of an amendment that occurred at the committee level. And that affected deliberations throughout the rest of the process. The floor had to address it. The congressional leaders had to address it. And it also affected the types of politics and coalitions that are going to pass that legislation. Obviously, when this amendment was adopted, it got maybe a handful of Republican votes and then all Democratic support, which this was a Republican Congress. So that was a little bit of an unusual coalition to be passing something, a provision onto a bill. But nonetheless, it completely changed how the legislation was debated, considered, and sent to the Senate. That language was later changed in the process to make it a study about how women being eligible for the Selective Service would impact the Selective Service. So the language is ultimately stripped. But, you know, all of that stuff can't be understood unless you kind of understand the dynamics of the committee, understand how individual members can and cannot affect the legislation and how it moves through the Congress, and individual members' motives. So this is all a very live process, and it's difficult to predict what's going to happen and what is going to pass the Congress and what kind of coalition is going to pass that piece of policy, because things often change on the fly. So we go through all these different things because it's important to understand each component of the process. Committees have their own sort of character and characteristics. Individual members are very, very different than when you're thinking about individual committees. They have very different political realities. Talking to these offices, a committee office and a personal office, is a very different dynamic because they have totally different focuses. Individual members are interested in their constituencies. Committees are interested in national legislation. So we go through all of these different things and more, but it's important to understand this environment because it's not an easy one-size-fits-all thing. The stuff that affects agriculture policy is different than the politics and events that affect national defense. So it's important to understand all these dynamics and that kind of content because every institutional and policy environment for agencies is going to be a little different based on the committees that deal with their issues and the constituencies that are most affected by them.
Do you ever offer courses on probability or possibility of a bill to pass?
No, we don't. We don't do that because, I mean, these things can all change, right? In this particular instance that I just mentioned about the National Defense Authorization Bill, that piece of legislation probably would not have passed the House floor if that amendment had stayed on there. So the question then became, how are you going to get this amendment off the bill? And there were a bunch of like procedural loopholes and jumps and hurdles that they had to go through. But we don't get into how the likelihood a bill is going to pass. The National Defense Authorization Act is a bill that almost always passes. There's no guarantee, but if you were going to score it, it would be very large. There's no real one-size-fits-all model here for what's going to become a law and what's not going to become a law. It's just kind of reading the tea leaves and trying to understand the environment in which it's being debated. So we try to provide that environment for federal workers so they know what's likely to pass, what's not likely to pass, what's going to fly under the radar that's really important, what's not going to fly under the radar, what's going to be sort of like the main political headline that, again, may not really affect the agency's authorization or appropriation. So just understanding that environment is really helpful for constituencies and for federal workers because you need to understand what's likely to change the operating programs of an agency and what's not, and why, where they fit within the kind of politics of a particular issue or policy.
Okay. And the last question from the listeners, did your guest predict a second impeachment? Is this a risky move for the Biden administration?
Yeah, nope, did not predict that at all. It's a little risky for the Biden administration in the sense that impeachment could derail some of his legislative priorities. So for example, the Biden administration is currently pushing a COVID relief package that's really, really important. In order to get to reconciliation, which is the process that allows you to get around the filibuster. So a bill only requires 51 votes under reconciliation, you have to pass a budget, right? So a budget needs to be adopted by the House and the Senate. And then you can start writing the reconciliation bill, which can then go through the Senate with only 51 votes. So impeachment has kind of eaten into that timeline because the amount of time that the Senate's been working on impeachment, they have not been working on reconciliation bills with the same kind of vigor that the House has. And so while the Senate was going through the impeachment trial last week, the House was busy writing pieces of legislation and provisions that are going to go into a COVID relief package that the Biden administration hopes to pass in order to address the pandemic and with vaccines, distribution, protective equipment. All of that stuff is in this large, large bill that's going to go through the process. So, you know, if it dragged out much longer, if witnesses had been called during impeachment, if more deposition was required, if more evidence had been introduced into the process, the delay for the Biden administration or the consequences for the Biden administration would be more further delayed action on this COVID relief package that they badly want to get through the House and through the Senate. So now that impeachment is sort of behind us, you can expect the Senate to look more intensely at finding the votes to pass that package. So that was the big risk. And now that it's gone, hopefully the Biden administration can start addressing some of the legislative priorities that they've really wanted to address since day one.
How large gap is there to overcome?
On the COVID relief stuff, well, yes. it's quite sizable. The Senate, the House will pass it pretty easily, I think. They've already marked up the legislation. It'll be moving to the floor pretty soon. The Senate has a totally different ballgame, and they've got to negotiate the reconciliation process, which comes with a lot of stipulations. Like, you can't just throw anything into a reconciliation bill, right? This is something that Democrats are finding out right now. They wanted to pass a minimum wage hike as part of this particular piece of legislation, but that's unlikely to be done because that violates some of the rules and restrictions of what can be in a budget reconciliation bill. This bill can only require budget related stuff, so regulations don't really count, or can't be included, I should say. So it's going to be difficult to see what Mr. Manchin and Ms. Sinema and Mr. Kelly and the senators from Georgia can really stomach when it comes to a legislative COVID bill. We're going to find out in the next week or two what they are willing to go along with. It'll probably be a little south of where President Biden would like to be, but I would be very surprised to see it stall at this point.
Okay, we got a minute and a half. Fire away.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting Congress because this is one of those things where you have reconciliation, but you can do it twice in a single year. And so despite the fact that Democrats are using their budget for the current fiscal year to pass COVID relief, they'll get another opportunity later in the year to have another non-filibusterable bill go through the process. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what Democrats turn to after COVID relief. There's a lot of belief that they might go towards expanding healthcare coverage in some way, shape, or form, either shoring up the ACA as it is, or maybe potentially expanding its coverage further through Medicaid and through the marketplaces. It's yet to be known what they're really going to do at this point in time.
Okay, we're coming down to 30 seconds. So again, your website.
Yep. You can find us at gai.georgetown.edu. And we'll keep you up to date on all this stuff from our academic/practitioner perspective.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure. My pen's out of ink. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WAPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.